Yes. You may proceed.
I'd ask to be allowed to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Four?
4 minutes, yes. And I'd also like to start by just saying good morning, sir. May it please the court, my name is Damon Robinson. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Irving Small, asking respectfully that this court remand this matter back to the Norfolk Circuit Court, either for a new trial or further hearings to determine whether it's appropriate to Mr. Small had presented enough evidence towards his affirmative defense to have this matter have given him a new trial.
Well, that's not the only question. You have to also establish that there was good cause and that the trial court abused its discretion in finding that the defendant did not have good cause.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the reason that I think under certain circumstances it may be appropriate to remand it for further proceedings is in my argument largely I base it on Judge Doyle's decision. I think the language he had in a reason for his decision only addressed part of the issue in determining whether or not Mr. Small should be given a new trial.
Well, the judge pointed out the delay was 2 years, 8 months to file the motion. Is that right?
Yes.
He also pointed out that that would put the trial at 4.5 years after the offense.
Correct.
That there have been 9 continuances.
Yes.
So the judge made all those points, and that's not the judge trying to politely say the defendant's gaming the system. I don't think there's good faith here.
I think so, but if the court looks at those 9 continuances, actually there were 11 continuances. 2 of those continuances were on the Commonwealth's motion over the defense objection, and there were 9 joint motions. So the Commonwealth, either on its own motion or along with the defendant's motion.
But I think the trial judge's point was, look, you knew your reasonable imminent danger point at the time you pled guilty, and you waited 2 years and 8 months to try to get out of it with something that you knew at the very beginning. It's not like it was a new thing, a new witness shows up, or the lawyer articulated a little better what the elements of the crime was, or any of that.
Well, my reading of the transcript from the hearing is that the attorney, Mr. Jeffrey Halleck, did not understand that the circumstances presented or didn't have all the factual information towards affirmative defense. I think Mr. Halleck in his opening addressed the fact that at the time I did not know somewhere, and I can point it out, but basically he said I didn't know at the time that he had been shot by the gentleman that he's testifying against in the subsequent proceeding, that he had also shot his friend and that it had took 4 days. He was aware that the defendant had a gun, and the gun was in his house, and where it was recovered from. And he knew that at the time, that he didn't know the subsequent, the information that would have provided the actual affirmative defense. So my understanding of what Mr. Halleck was attempting to present through his proffer, one is that the information that he was proffering only became known perhaps is that of a guilty plea. And as such, I think a good faith basis, or at least a defendant relying on his attorney's advice, and I think Mr. Halleck also said that it was his advice to the defendant based on what he knew at the point that he should plead guilty, and he kind of fell on his sword a little bit where he said it was my fault that I advised him to plead guilty and not knowing the information regarding the possible affirmative defense of necessity. As it goes back to the timing of the incident, the defendant entered his plea, and again, asking to be allowed to withdraw the plea, the statute only again provides one requirement as far as time, and I think the case law additionally, not the case law, but the statute says it has to be before sentencing. And so I think it actually was before the sentencing. It was, I think, a year before the sentencing occurred, despite the fact that it was 2 or 3 years after the defendant actually entered his guilty plea.
Right. The point is not that he's somehow under a statute of limitations, but that good cause does take into account the fact that people are sleeping on their alleged rights and not alerting the trial court to something that was incredibly important from the defendant's point of view.
Well, and again, I would point out to the court, I think that Mr. Smalls is, again, relying on the advice of counsel and what his counsel was aware of. And if he's not a lawyer, he didn't go to law school, he doesn't understand, you know, all the nuances of every defense. And for a large part, defendants, criminal defendants, rely on the advice of their attorney. And so if his attorney doesn't present him with possible defenses that he has, and then he learns those defenses, whether those defenses are, you know, 2 months or 2 years, if it's before the sentencing, I think as a defendant, he's relying on what he's presenting good faith. When he pled guilty, he accepted responsibility. I think even in the proffer, Mr. Halleck said the defendant isn't suggesting he never possessed a gun, or but he has a reason for it that I did not know at the time would provide him with the defense for the claim. So again, he's relying on the person that our justice system puts in control of, advising them of what rights they have available. And I think largely, again, it wasn't necessarily a situation where the Commonwealth is objecting continuously to these continuances. They asked for two of the continuances, they joined in the motion. And another thing, I think that Judge Dole erroneously relied on the fact that it was a prejudice to the Commonwealth attorney. The Commonwealth attorney herself did not say that the situation presented where the witnesses were no longer available. I think her statement exactly was that they're conceivably available, that one of them was still in the area and one of them had moved out of the area, but they could still be subpoenaed. So
let me change the subject for a minute and get you back on track. Is there a viable defense here? The man claims he was shot 4 days earlier, hardly any detail as to what's going on here, and then the statute that says he is absolutely precluded from having a firearm is set aside. Would any trial judge even give that instruction?
And part of the reason that I think it may be appropriate for it to be remanded for further proceedings is there was, in the beginning of Mr. Halleck's proffer, he says, I have an aunt here, I have these people here who I can give this information to. And Judge Dole says, wait, I want to hear more information about the timing of this. Those witnesses were never given an opportunity to testify about, again, the nature, the full nature and circumstances behind whether or not the defendant had a reasonable belief of imminent harm.
So let me pause you there. So are you, and don't let me trap you into a
Absolutely, session. I know the court, I have an idea what the court
is. Are you saying that you agree or disagree that the vague and arguably incomplete proffer would meet, or I'll make it even easier, not meet, the reasonable necessity standard, but that if you'd had the opportunity to put the witness on, witnesses plural on, you may have provided the necessary facts? Which of the two, and it's a careful question, so answer it carefully.
Absolutely, and I wish I could give the court a more exact answer. I don't know if the court can tell either way from the record. I think there is a basic idea of the elements of the necessity defense. The issue that I think is difficult in me being able to make the argument to the court is that the judge never gave any indication towards whether or not how he considered those factors. We know that there was some information given to the court, but the court said, before you finish, let me go. Let me ask you these questions. But there was a part where Judge Dole actually says that I know if I remand this case back, this defendant may be able to put on further evidence of his affirmative defense. So from that four or five...
Well, you see where this is going, I hope, is that if that's the case, you're in deep trouble because your opportunity to put that proffer on was before it comes to us.
Well, I think it's not a full proffer. I mean, we know that whether, you know, the term reasonable... you know, to be determined by the fact finder. And so we know he was shot, and it kind of falls within the two cases that I think have generally been argued. One case determined imminent was, I believe it was the Humphreys case where it was really imminent. There's the shooting from the trailer while being shot, and there's another case where the defendant had, and the court said, of course, doing the shooting back and forth, that defendant should have been entitled to a necessity instruction. But there was one case that was 12 days, and then the court says 12 days is too far attenuated from, you know, that. So we have a case where there's 4 days. So you have, you know, case law says, you know, immediately yes, 12 days, no, we have 4 days. And then we have a judge who, in this instance, from what I read, did not give any clarity about how he determine the other evidence, how he felt the evidence presented one way or another would have been able to sustain an affirmative defense. So if you're asking me for my personal opinion, I don't know how much weight that's going to carry with the court, but my personal opinion would be, I think that there is enough of a, based on that, a necessity defense, that it was a question of whether or not a jury instruction, of course, is a till of the evidence. I think that would probably be enough to give an instruction to the jury. Whether or not I think that's enough under these circumstances to say that this defendant should automatically, just from this court, receive a new trial, I don't feel comfortable necessarily saying that, but I do think that remanding this for further proceeding to determine whether or not, to give an opportunity to fully present evidence regarding the circumstances behind the necessity defense.
Counsel, why didn't he, I mean, if the judge says, no, I'm not going to let you put your evidence on, why didn't he make a full proffer? I mean, we don't usually remand for an additional evidence.
Absolutely. It was a different, I wasn't trial counsel.
I understand that.
I can generalize. I mean, typically if a judge says, I don't want to hear any more of that, I want to hear this.
Then proffer.
And there was some proffer, and he had a witness there. I can't give the court an explanation about, you know, why he didn't.
Your client has a remedy; it's just not in this proceeding.
Well, I think there maybe I think there is a remedy. I think again, you have a judge who, we're talking abuse of discretion, says, "Listen, this wasn't timely filed. I'm not as necessarily worried about whether or not it's a." He has this affirmative defense because it wasn't timely raised.
Yeah, but independent of that, let's say that just hypothetically we agreed with you that on your prejudice to the Commonwealth argument.
Yeah.
So that all we have to do is look at, did he put on enough evidence so that to show that you can get to the jury on the question of imminence?
And
I don't see it. It's not there, and you're saying, and you don't think it's there either.
Well,
because you're saying, well, let's go back.
Well,
and you can't do that.
I understand, of course, and I don't know if I fully said. I think there's enough evidence in the situation of a jury. There would get an instruction. I do believe that. Whether or not, if it's enough for a jury or fact finder to say that, you know, this is clearly enough information, of course, I can't say that. But
that's the point. Think this through. That's exactly the same thing. We won't JNOV a jury verdict on anything until we say no rational person could have found more than a scintilla of the evidence for that proposition, which is exactly the standard the trial judge uses when the trial judge figures out whether or not to give or not give a jury instruction. The trial judge asks, hypothetically, could a rational fact finder find more than a scintilla of evidence? So the disconnect between those two standards, to me, I think is part of the flaw that we're trying to develop here.
I understand the dilemma, and I wish there was a more certain answer I can give. Again, I think that through his proffer, I would suggest he meets the element of addressing the affirmative defense.
Counsel, what did the judge mean when he said, secondly, on page 109 of the appendix, I can't rule out that the circumstances and something that happened during the offense might actually relate to the court determining whether to believe the affirmative defense. There might be details about how the defendant acted at the time, what the defendant said, something of that nature that would now become very material and important to the trial. What did he mean when he was talking about the nature of the affirmative defense?
And I think part of, again, that goes to the argument that the judge just, did not fully care to hear that, not fully care, I don't know if that's incorrect, but that he was stuck on the timing issue, and that if given a court hearing, the defendant basically probably could prove or present enough evidence that would suggest that his affirmative defense was an affirmative defense that should be presented to a jury, and that a reasonable person could if he was given the opportunity to. But in this chance, I'm not giving him the opportunity to because I believe that the timing of the issue foregoes all other issues, and that's the issue. So I think, again, that statement is the judge basically saying to the fact finder that, yes, this probably would be an affirmative defense, but it was raised at an appropriate time.
So it seems like to me what you're saying is that the judge based his ruling primarily on the timing.
Absolutely. I think that was most of the argument. I think the statement that the justice presented shows that he suggests that there is a basis for the affirmative defense, but that's precluded by, and again, he used the terms, I simply believe or I simply find that the timing is a prejudice to the Commonwealth, and that's the only factor that he considered.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jeffrey?
Good morning, may it please the Court. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. To answer your last question, Justice Goodwin, my read of the record is that at trial, what Judge Doyle did was relied solely on the prejudice prong. The reasonable defense part of this that Justice Kelsey was alluding to in some of his questions first really came to fruition in the Court of Appeals. So that's how that issue really got in front of you. Because and in the Court of Appeals, it was actually, my reading of it, it was fairly cursory, but it was a twofold ruling. We're ratifying what the trial judge did, and we're also saying that for the first time that there, as a matter of law, wasn't a reasonable defense offered. So that's really how the record shook out. The issue of prejudice obviously is before the court. There's a substantial delay.
Can I interrupt you there for a second, sir, on that last point? Everything you just said is true, of course, but the quote from the record that Justice Lacy just mentioned, when I read that, I hear that as a trial judge saying, I don't have some things I need in order to agree with you, defendant, that you have a viable defense on imminency. I just don't have that. And then the trial judge thinks, but honestly, logically, I don't need it because I have another ground. I would think that is not the trial judge shutting anybody down, but maybe even arguably implicitly saying, if you have something on this subject, now's the time to bring it to my attention. Because I'm telling you, I don't have enough to work with your reasonable defense argument. Would you say it's fair, or is that too much of an extrapolation of what is happening in the trial court?
I don't think it's an unfair reading, Justice. Sorry, I'm sure I have the appendix here.
The reason it's important to me is that's different from a trial judge doing what I think the defendant is saying, which is, I'm not hearing that, I don't want to hear it, and I'm just going to do what I want to do. In which case, they still have to proffer, but it does weaken the equities of the case.
No, I think that's absolutely a fair read. And to be perfectly frank, and this is just one person's opinion from reading the record, Justice Kelsey, I think if you look at it in context, he very much said, I'm going to resolve this on the prejudice prong, but I don't think what you said is unfair either, and I certainly don't think it's fair to look at this record and say anybody got, to sort of use the colloquialism, cut off at the knees here. There's nothing in this record that screams that out at all. They made the proffer at this very hearing in terms of the time lapse and what had transpired.
And the trial judge said, that's inadequate. It's not specified enough for me to work with it.
I think that's probably fair. But again, I think a fair reading of the record was his primary purpose was the prejudice. But absolutely right to hit on what Justice Lacy indicated. In the context where he was making that response, he was kind of grappling with whether there was some posture where he could, at the motions hearing, essentially force the defendant to stipulate to the Commonwealth's case in chief and then go back solely on the defense. And that's part of the backdrop for how that comment was made. So you know, I'm not entirely certain he was thinking too much about the adequacy of the proffer. At that point, he certainly was sort of thinking, is there a way that I could even do this procedurally where the fact that there has been the time lapse isn't going to be a problem for the
Fair enough. You've answered it. Thank you.
And I think he certainly said no. I would like to answer. I would like to respond to one thing with respect to the delay and the prejudice. And counsel did correctly represent that the Commonwealth's attorney said essentially we might well be able to get the witnesses here. One is still in town and they're still available. Obviously, the trial judge isn't absolutely bound by that type of proffer, and I would point out to the court, I mean, the time delay alone, I mean, he posited one possible scenario, the trial judge did, as far as how the Commonwealth could be prejudiced, but just think about how these cases play out sort of in real courtrooms. I mean, you've basically got police officers coming into court with their written reports from an incident that happened some time ago, and oftentimes, I mean, I've certainly seen this in records and in trial courts, a police officer will be asked a question, most often a police officer witness, will look down at the report and say, first of all, it's not in my report, and I don't really have an independent recollection of that. And I think that fact is only heightened when you've got this time lapse in the case. So I don't think there's anything plainly wrong about the trial judge's finding in that respect as far as the prejudice. And that, frankly, it ought to be dispositive here.
Mr. Jeffries,
yes,
there are several cases from the Court of Appeals that talk about prejudice. I couldn't find one from our court where in the parish justice alignment we have relied on prejudice. Did I miss one?
You have not, Your Honor. To my knowledge, there is not one. It would be an issue of first impression in this court. I don't disagree with what Justice Kelsey said in terms of, you know, does it somehow overlap in terms of the good faith? Is it part of good faith? And I think that's certainly, that's a viable argument. In fact, probably one, I think it's one I considered when I wrote the brief, and then I decided not to make that directly. It's never been addressed in this court. As I pointed out in a footnote in the brief, the Court of Appeals obviously has dealt with it, and I can tell the court, and I've given multiple citations, that the federal courts, under their similar rules, I think it's currently under Rule 11, you'll have some prior ones under Rule 32, I think. They've always said prejudice to the government is part of the test. So certainly in the federal system, with a very similar type of motion, that certainly got widespread acceptance in the federal courts. I will also point out that in that footnote in the Hubbard case from the Court of Appeals, there is a citation to at least one case from this court. I think it's Commonwealth versus Williams, which I actually cited on brief for another proposition. The court points out that this court has previously found that a delay in asserting rights that could prejudice the Commonwealth could basically forfeit your right to raise them. It was not the context of withdrawal of guilty plea, but that's a long-winded answer to your question, Justice Powell. The court, I think, has previously said it in related or similar context, I should say, but not this one. It's never been an issue in this court.
Counsel, let me walk through a potential procedural conundrum. The trial court found against the defendant, the appellant, solely based upon prejudice.
Right.
Okay, which is a matter of first impression for us. Again, hypothetically, if we were to find that there is no prejudice to the Commonwealth here because of the fact that at least one witness is still available, so that we're only then looking at the second issue, which is the imminent harm.
Correct.
Trial judge never ruled on that. The Commonwealth didn't file cross error saying, well, there was a second grounds. And the Court of Appeals relied upon that as one of its two grounds. So if we were to find no prejudice, could we still uphold the Court of Appeals on the issue of the imminent harm?
Yeah, I think that based on this court's right result, wrong reason jurisprudence, that the Court of Appeals was entitled to affirm on any basis. They didn't articulate that rationale. It's a purely legal basis, and I would submit to the court, because as you're aware of Justice Mims, there certainly are things in this court's jurisprudence that say if additional factual development is required, you can't necessarily apply that. And what I would submit to you is that based on the imminent harm, the imminence requirement drawn fairly tight, certainly in the courts that have addressed this across the country, and the Court of Appeals of Virginia, as a matter of law, this shooting 3 or 4 days out or whatever it was is just not enough. And part of that is, and you'll see some of this bleeding through in a number of the federal cases I cited, is that we're going to draw the noose pretty tight with these felon in possession cases. If you look at them over and over again, and I pointed out a couple of these on brief, a couple of places where they said, look, this fear may have been entirely rational. But after...
You've actually answered my question. Although if you want to continue and argue the imminent harm of... It's an issue, but my question has been answered.
Okay. I think that's my answer to your procedural question. It's got to be imminent. The Crittenden from the Fourth Circuit was somebody who had been shot. Byers from the Court of Appeals was somebody who had been shot. And really, if you look at the record, and remember, most of these are jury instruction cases, so the appellate courts are reading these records in the light most favorable to the defendant in terms of the denial of a jury instruction. And they say, look, it's imminent. And really, if you look, Paolillo and Panter, which are cases that were cited on brief, were situations where essentially, at least if you accepted the defendant at his word, that the harm was right there. The gun was right up in his face. The attack was right there in the bar where one of the guys was working as a bartender. I mean, it literally has to be that tight. And that, again, is because of the necessity for felon in possession laws to be drawn that way. And it is as a matter of law. That it's before you, and it can be adjudicated on that basis. I would submit to the court.
Thank you.
Now, I made some procedural arguments with respect to the prejudice element. I rely on my brief for those. And I also indicated, too, that I would certainly question the adequacy of the record. I don't know that the court needs to reach this here. But there's no record of the Alfred colloquy when this gentleman entered his guilty plea. And any number of times you'll see people complaining about, I think I've got this, that, or the other defense. We just don't know what this gentleman said or what he was apprised of at the time. Like, oftentimes there is some discussion on the record, and without knowing what he was saying and how aware he may have been of it, it's really, I think, difficult for this court to resolve it. And I did point out, and I'm not going to bore you with the tedious details of this, that there seems to be a little bit of friction, I think, between this court's jurisprudence as to how much reliance you can put on the colloquy or what you can't rely upon. And that's one reason I made the argument about the lack of the adequacy of the record, was because I think that at least with some of those things, you might expect, at least in some cases, a defendant might well have been talking about, hey, look, I think I would be able to defend this case, but my lawyers told me it's not a good defense or whatever. We just don't have enough of a record either. But again, for all the other reasons that the various principles that we've cited, I think that the case could be resolved on other grounds as well. Unless the court has further questions, I'll submit.
Thank you. Call the next case.